Welcome, everybody, to the CLDF GAP PBC podcast series. I'm Dr. Kimberly Brown. I'm a professor of medicine at Wayne State University and Michigan State University, and I'm joined by my good friend and colleague, Dr. Stephen Flam, professor of medicine at Rush University. And the topic tonight is to talk about the importance of the impact of disease outcomes, the progression to fibrosis and cirrhosis in patients with PBC. So this is a pretty informal conversation. Steve and I are just going to be talking about some of the things that we see as hepatologists. So welcome, Steve. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you so much, Kim, and hello, everybody.
So I think one of the things that I know I face in clinical practice, and probably you do as well, is helping clinicians understand kind of the general concept of how liver disease progresses. And we're talking about PBC, but I think maybe helping, you know, them understand how liver disease progresses and, you know, from start to finish. And we'll talk about some of the implications, I think, of when patients get to advanced liver disease. But how do you explain it to your patients?
Well, you know, Kim, primary biliary cholangitis is one of the diseases, like many in liver disease, where we don't understand it very well. Not everybody does develop advanced liver disease. And when somebody does, the rate of the development of the fibrosis is completely unpredictable.
Yeah.
So I tell patients it's very, very important to intervene early in this disease state. It's important to follow patients very, very carefully. And I tell them that we must follow the development of fibrosis on them on a regular basis to ensure that we're not missing anything and that we are treating them as aggressively as we need to. And you can't be tricked by their symptoms either. Many patients, as you know, Kim, don't have symptoms early on with these diseases like PBC, and yet they're developing fibrotic liver disease. So you really have to assess the patient's labs and assess their fibrosis as time goes on.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point because, you know, I think when you and I trained, we were taught that if you had PBC and were asymptomatic, you were probably safe, that you, you know, had very little risk moving forward. I think that that's probably not true. I mean, we do see patients who have no symptoms. Maybe their symptoms are fatigue or, you know, maybe some degree of pruritus, but really have progressive disease. And I agree with you. I think it's important to follow those patients over time to monitor for that. When you see patients who maybe are newly diagnosed or perhaps come to your practice and you're making the diagnosis, do you find that most of them have early disease, or do you find that some of them actually, over time, maybe the diagnosis has been missed and they have more advanced disease?
You know, I, like you, have a practice at a tertiary care center, so I think there's a little bit more of a bias to having people with more liver disease because we get referral of sicker people. But there are certainly many, many patients that are referred to me from the primary care practitioners in our practice that just have elevated serum alkaline phosphatase. They may or may not have fatigue and or pruritus. And then I make the diagnosis. And those patients often have very mild liver disease, occasionally advanced liver disease. Patients that I get referred to from other gastroenterologists who have already been evaluated and maybe followed for some time, ones that aren't necessarily a new diagnosis, they tend to be sicker people, cirrhotic patients, occasionally decompensated cirrhotic patients, and require liver transplantation evaluation. So, you know, in a practice like mine, I'm sure yours is similar, I have a full gamut of patients, a full spectrum of patients that present with you know, all kinds of different disease. How about for you?
Yeah, I agree with you. I think that oftentimes I see that in patients who are referred, you can look back and they've actually had abnormal liver tests for many years in some cases prior to a diagnosis. So I agree with you. We do see patients with advanced liver disease where in retrospect, it's been PBC all along, but we also have patients, you know, where a new diagnosis is made and the amount of fibrosis that they have is variable depending on how long they've had the disease.
And what is interesting is once you have the patient in your practice, even patients that have a certain amount of fibrosis, some of them seem to progress very slowly, particularly when they're on medical therapy, and others progress more quickly. Within 2 or 3 or 4 years, you start to see their bilirubin rise, their symptoms worsen, and them develop more advanced liver disease. So I found it to be very unpredictable.
Yeah.
PBC.
So, you know, it brings me to another question, which is, you know, for our listeners, help our listeners, I think, understand what are the implications of fibrosis progression? I mean, we talk about trying to prevent progression of fibrosis, but why are we trying to do that, right? What are the implications of somebody with advanced liver disease or cirrhosis?
I think there's 2 or 3 reasons, Kim, at least why I follow fibrosis very carefully. First of all, if I see somebody that's having more rapidly progressive fibrosis, I become more worried about them. And I really pull out all the stops in terms of aggressive medical therapy. I make sure patients get the message that they need to follow up very regularly, maybe more frequently, and that we need to treat them aggressively. And there are some new medical therapies for patients that aren't responding as well to URSO as they should be. Secondly, if patients are progressing rapidly, I doubly and triply make sure that they don't have other secondary causes of liver disease that I might need to intervene on, like they're drinking or they have concomitant fatty liver, things that you might not be as focused on because you're focused on their PBC. But if they have rapidly progressive liver disease, you really need to focus on other possible causes too. And lastly, when patients develop advanced liver disease for any cause, but PBC included, they are at risk for liver cancer and esophageal varices. And when they get advanced liver disease, of course, I do the screening that's necessary for liver cancer with semi-annual liver ultrasounds or cross-sectional imaging if I need to, and AFPs. And I do an upper endoscopy to rule out esophageal varices because patients, if they have varices, may benefit from variceal bleeding prophylaxis with non-cardioselective beta blockers. So I follow fibrosis very carefully in these patients, symptomatic or not. You cannot be lulled into a false sense of security with these people. And you really need to, I watch them because I think in the end, we all want our patients to do well. And this is how you optimize their outcomes. What do you do? Why do you assess fibrosis in your patients?
Yeah, I think it's really important, as you pointed out, to follow patients over time. You know, having a fibrosis assessment 5 years ago doesn't count. As you pointed out, some people progress more rapidly. You need to know when their risk really starts to accelerate. And I think cirrhosis, obviously, is what we know in all patients really accelerates that risk. Development of portal hypertension, but screening them for evidence of portal hypertension, the sequelae, the encephalopathy, the ascites, the varices, cancer. That's really important. And then, you know, you and I are both sitting in transplant centers. At some point, these patients may need to advance to transplant consideration. So I think for all of those reasons, it's important to understand where they are you know, with respect to their degree of fibrosis.
Absolutely. And, you know, in PBC, you have to be very cognizant of bilirubin elevations.
Yeah.
More so than in other diseases. You know, in the liver world, we get used to very high bilirubin levels, for instance, in alcohol-associated hepatitis, where patients have a normal bilirubin and within a month or two may have a bilirubin of 20. So we become become numb a little bit to lower level bilirubin elevations. But in PBC, when the bilirubin just starts to rise to 2 or 3, what we would otherwise consider very low level elevations, it is very important in this population. This is a predictor for bad outcomes and bad outcomes soon. So I think the listeners should be aware of that. And when they see bilirubin elevations in their patients, they need to be very, very worried about them.
Yeah, I think that's a very important point because I see it as a, you know, we focus so much on alkaline phosphatase. Many of those patients, obviously, you know, we're treating to an endpoint, which is alkaline phosphatase. But I completely agree with you. Once that bilirubin starts to move, that patient's in trouble. That patient needs to be really monitored much more closely. And it's not a good prognostic sign in any way, and very different than our other patients where we might tolerate a bilirubin rise in other circumstances without pushing a trigger.
Absolutely. You know, I think the moral of the story, Kim, as you're alluding to with the questions, is, you know, PBC patients have really an unpredictable clinical course. And practitioners, if you really want to optimize the outcome for the patient, really have to follow them closely. You have to see them in the office a couple of times a year. And you have to monitor their labs a couple of times a year, unless the labs are very bad, and then you might get them more frequently. But you really have to monitor these people and monitor their fibrosis. And don't forget to be very aggressive with medical therapy, because you can delay or maybe even obviate progression of liver disease down the road if you treat these patients the way they're supposed to be treated with URSO, and then second line therapy if, you know, if second line therapy is appropriate.
So let me ask you to talk a little bit about, for our listeners, the ways in which you assess fibrosis. I mean, we have a lot of different ways to look at the liver. We have ultrasound, we have MR, we have CAT scans, we have fiber scans, we have, you know, biochemical testing. Scores that we can calculate. Talk a little bit about what you tend to choose in your practice and maybe some of the pitfalls of some of those methods in terms of diagnosing advancing fibrosis or monitoring for advancing fibrosis.
Yeah, Kim, that's a great question for all liver disease, but PBC too. The non-invasive testing of hepatic fibrosis, I think, has revolutionized our assessments on the stage of liver disease, because until about 10 to 15 years ago, we used to have to do liver biopsy on our patients just to stage the disease, even when we knew the diagnosis. And now we rarely have to do that anymore, which is a good thing. And as you alluded to, there are two large categories of these kinds of tests that the practitioners should be aware of. One are blood tests, and one are imaging tests. And in the blood test world, there are what I call the free ones. FIB4 and APRI are examples, where they're free because they use data that everybody has on patients to begin with. Liver enzymes, platelet count, the age of the patient. And if you Google the formula and you put the values in, you get a number. It doesn't cost you anything. And then there are the proprietary blood tests like FibroSure and ELF, which is the enhanced liver fibrosis test. And I think they're a little better than the free ones, but they're not free and you actually have to order them. Now, when I'm in a clinic that I don't have easy access to an imaging procedure, I order the blood test. I order the blood tests or I use the free blood tests. Keeping in mind that they're not right all of the time. They're right about 70 to 75% of the time, give or take, depending on which test you're talking about. But they give you a pretty good assessment whether a patient has very little liver damage or a lot. Now, the imaging tests are a little better, particularly elastography, you know, vibration-controlled transient elastography or shear wave elastography, if you happen to have access to those in your clinic or near your clinic. And then there's MRE, which is probably the best of all of the non-invasive fibrosis tests, but that requires special equipment. It's very expensive. Insurance often doesn't like that test. So in my office where I have a FibroScan or where I have access to it, I use that because I think that's a little better than the blood tests and it's very easy and you get the results right away. So that's what I use. Keeping in mind, I think you were asking, what are the pitfalls? One of the things to recall is they're not always right. They're not always right. I sometimes have a nodular appearing liver on imaging, and then I get a FibroScan or somebody orders one, and it says no fibrosis or stage one fibrosis. Doesn't happen often, but it happens sometimes. And, you know, you have to keep in mind that the test may not be correct. Also, with FibroScan in particular, if the liver has a lot of congestion in it for some reason, either from congestive heart failure or acute hepatitis or some other cause of hepatic congestion, alcohol-associated hepatitis, you may get an overestimate of how much hepatic fibrosis there is. That doesn't happen too much with PBC, but it's something to keep in mind when you're using these non-invasive tests. So I use the elastography test when I can or the proprietary blood test if I can't. What do you do in Detroit?
I would say it's the same for us. Now, we have access, as you do, to elastography. I find, or at least I think, that it's most useful for me to monitor a patient with the same test over time, so I have a comparator. I wonder your thoughts about, you know, the Fib4 and the APRI. They're in a lot of our algorithms for primary care clinicians. And I wonder your thoughts about whether they're more useful for sort of risk stratifying patients initially, or whether you think those tests can be used at all to monitor a patient over time.
That's a great question, too. I think those tests are particularly good for risk stratification initially, especially for diseases like fatty liver, which we see so often, so commonly. And we in the GI and hepatology world can't see all of those patients. So we need some risk stratification to help refer patients to us that we need to see. With PBC, you know, again, I would probably get the, you know, the higher level tests. And yeah, I agree with you 100%. You should use the same test if you can to monitor patients serially. You know, getting different tests probably can be confounding at times when you're trying to compare point A and point B and point C. So that's a very, very important and good point. What do you use? I mean, in the liver world, I don't see Fib4 and APRI used as much. It's more in the primary care world or at the first level. Are you guys in Detroit using Fib4 and APRI?
No, but I do, you know, in trying to help clinicians understand how to diagnose, but importantly, how to monitor a patient. My personal opinion is APRI and Fib4 are better for initial testing for risk stratification and not very useful to monitor a patient over time. They really haven't ever been used in that way clinically. The other thing that, you know, I would also say is I don't think imaging is particularly helpful. Ultrasound, cross-sectional imaging for monitoring a patient for advancing fibrosis. I think they're important to monitor patients once we know they're at risk of liver cancer, et cetera. But many of those tests, and I think that's important for our listeners to understand the limitations, right? You can't, unless a patient has very advanced disease or evidence of portal hypertension, you can't do an ultrasound and exclude fibrosis, for example. So I think that understanding the limitations of those tests are important as well.
Yeah, when I was using the phrase imaging, I was referring to elastography.
Absolutely, right.
Not just the usual tests that we get to visualize liver, like ultrasound or CT or MRI.
Yeah.
You're 100% correct. By the time those tests show abnormalities, the horse is out of the barn. I mean,
right.
The battle is almost lost. So yes, where elastography tests, what I call the imaging tests, rather than the blood tests.
So, any final comments that you want to make, Steve, regarding, fibrosis progression or, the implications of cirrhosis in this patient population before we sign up?
Yeah, Kim, I just think that with all a liver disease, PBC2, that you can't be lulled into a false sense of security when patients don't have a lot of symptoms, because they can progress from a fibrosis standpoint. Also, patients can sometimes progress quickly. Thirdly, really think in your mind if patients have a second cause of liver disease that you need to intervene on. Don't always get focused on what's right in front of you, like PBC. And fourthly, don't forget to screen your patients with advanced liver disease for liver cancer. There are more malpractice cases nowadays for missed liver cancer diagnosis than you can believe. And, not that we practice just to not have a lawsuit, but the point is it's the standard of care. Patients, if you miss a liver cancer that's small because you're not screening, you really have a bad outcome potentially for the patient. So I think those are my thoughts that I would like to convey to the listeners. How about you?
Yeah, no, those are all really great points. I think we both are in agreement that we can't stress enough how important it is to understand the degree of fibrosis that your patient has, and very important to monitor that patient over time, given the change in risk. And also potentially the change in opportunity as new medications, new therapies become available to them.
Absolutely.
So, well, I just want to thank the listeners for joining us for the CLDF Gap PBC podcast series. And thank you for joining us tonight. And hopefully we'll see you at the next podcast.